stones, looking for fun and feeling cruising.
Good morning, Reading. Well, it's perfect out again, and this is Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. And no, there was not snow in San Francisco last night, just in case you're wondering.
Yeah, and we didn't get snow here either in Reading.
No.
I kept on waiting for it because it was raining a little bit last night, and it was getting cooler, and I told my wife, hey, yeah, we might get some snow, but no.
Nah, we got skipped.
So we missed our blizzard chance.
We did. So, hey, in the studio today, we have the crew from Kent's Meats out on Airport Road, and we're going to talk about Prather Ranch Beef, and we know that's one of my favorite local beef groups. And we had James Rickert on the show here a while back, and you know, we're proud of their commitment to hormone-free, antibiotic-free beef. And so in the studio, we have Todd Fremmer and Bo Marvel from Kent's Meats. Welcome, you guys.
Thank you.
Hey, glad to have you here. Now, out at Kent's, you guys have a whole new thing going that you know, I was out at Kent's doing my regular thing where I buy a couple of my favorite pieces of beef, and I was attacked by people at the store, and they're in the studio now, showing me new products that they're carrying. And so you guys have a whole new line of things you're doing with Prather Ranch beef that you just have been doing a couple months. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What are you making out there?
Oh, we're making bratwurst, snack sticks, jerky, pastrami.
Okay, what started this? What motivated you to decide to branch out? Did you have more beef than you used to have? Or did you just, were you creative? Were you having like a moment of creativity? Or
no, we're just trying to creep into a market area we've never been in before and produce more products locally.
Okay, well then let's go through these one by one. Now, I bought like as many different things as I could, and I tried to eat them this week, you know, but I didn't make it through a couple of them, but the things I did try were extraordinary. So we started out with like a long stick of jerky that I think had some cheese in it. It was extraordinary. What the heck was that?
Cheddar cheese snack stick.
Okay, now that would
be our own little creation.
That's great.
A good one.
A good one. Okay, now what's in that? But without giving away trade secrets.
Mostly the ingredients are salt, pepper, and cheddar cheese.
Hey, simple.
And smoked, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Now, does that take a long time to make? Is that fast? It looks just so hard.
In the stuffing process, it is a little slow because they're such a small diameter.
Okay.
They're a little labor intensive.
Now, then, another thing I had that has nothing to do with Prather Ranch beef, it has to do with all-natural pork, is that you had a sausage out there that was uncooked, and you had a whole big tray of them. Now, what was that thing called? Was that the bratwurst?
Those are our grillers, yeah.
Those are grillers?
That was probably bratwurst.
Okay.
We make several different flavors. We do original bratwurst, a cheddar cheese bratwurst, and a sun-dried tomato and herb.
Okay.
And they're a low-salt sausage.
Okay. And now, we were just sort of guessing on how to cook that. What were we supposed to do with that for real?
Grill them.
Grill it. Okay, well,
fry it.
Barbecue
fry
sausage.
Fry it.
Yeah, we baked it, so.
We have a new one coming out, too.
What's coming out, Todd?
Jeff will tell you.
Oh, yeah,
the
Jeff.
Cheddar cheese, yeah.
Yep. More cheddar cheese.
More cheese. Can there be too much cheese?
No.
Okay. All right, so then there was also a jerky that I didn't get to try yet, and I was looking at it this morning, and I'm like, oh, I haven't tried that jerky. And so,
why are you waiting?
I don't know. I was up. I had, like, traditional breakfast foods, not jerky this morning.
Yeah.
So what's in the jerky and what motive? How hard is it to make jerky? It sounds so difficult.
It's pretty simple. Jerky's kind of Todd's baby.
Okay, no. Jerky guy.
We do two different flavors of Prather Ranch jerky. We do a teriyaki and a honey-glazed teriyaki.
Okay.
I like the honey-glazed.
Yeah, we just started that one.
Did you? Now, Todd, have you made jerky kind of a long time?
25 years.
25
probably.
Years of jerky making.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And then you just now are deciding to share
marinate.
It with us?
Yeah. Well, we used the same marinade that we use for our tri-tips on Friday.
Oh.
Soak it in there and then do some secret stuff.
Secret stuff. See, these are the things we don't really get to talk about on the radio,
no.
But we're trying. Okay. No,
can't
I haven't tried it, so I don't know except that it looked great.
It's fantastic.
And then there was another product that you had that was kind of almost like a salami. I didn't get to try it. It's in the freezer. It was a link.
Oh, probably a cheddarwurst. That was a Prather Ranch cheddarwurst.
Okay, Prather Ranch cheddarwurst.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what's in that one? Same?
All beef. It's 100% beef sausage.
Okay.
It has cheddar cheese. Again, it's a bratwurst. So the primary ingredients are salt, white pepper, black pepper, ground garlic, and onion powder.
Now, was that one pre-cooked?
Yeah, fully smoked.
Okay, it's fully smoked. Okay, and then when we come back, I'm going to talk about the pastrami, and then I just want to talk about the history of Kent's Meats a little bit. You know, you guys have been there a while, and for people who are like Kent's...
34 years.
Okay, yeah. We're going to come back and talk about that. So you're listening to Positively Healthy. I'm Dr. Trudy Pratt. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
What do you look for in a building contractor?
You got to make...
Welcome back. Hey, you're listening to Positively Healthy on KCNR 1460. And in the studio, we have Bo Marvel and Todd Fremmer from Kent's Meats out on Airport Road. Welcome back, guys. Appreciate you being here today. And, you know, we were talking about, before we took our break, you have one product that I think it might even be, well, they're all good, but the flagship product that's new might just be that pastrami. I mean, I don't know if I can stop eating it. So
yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so what's the magic there? I mean, how do you make pastrami? Is that all about aging and curing or what?
It's all about curing and flavors. Our pastrami is a scratch recipe. Starts out with just onions and garlic and cayenne pepper, and you boil that and just keep adding to it.
The deep cut we use is unique too, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Is that why it sort of separates like that? Or
yeah, it's a brisket.
It's a brisket.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's really good.
It is good.
And now, what do they look for when they go out there? Do they look for the Prather on some of these things? What they look for, the Prather Ranch sticker?
We have both. Prather and regular.
Okay, so then they can, since we're kind of promoting the Prather thing, because
right.
I want everybody to have the hormone-free antibiotic
Prather's
foods.
Prather's a bit more expensive, but for the quality, not
It was
at
still
all, we
inexpensive,
think.
I thought.
Right,
yeah.
And
so they
so.
Just look for that sticker that says Prather Ranch on it.
Can't miss it.
Can't miss it. Okay. And then, Todd, the history, how did you guys get your affiliation with the Prather Ranch beef? You know, it's sold all over the United States, and it's just, we're so lucky to have it here.
Well, in the 50s, my dad knew the Rickards, Jim Rickards' father.
And let's just make it clear that your dad is Kent.
Yeah,
okay.
Excuse me. Yeah, Kent. He knew the Rickards from the 50s. And Jim, when he got affiliated with Prather, he come to Kent, and they hooked up, and from there it's been good ever since. I mean...
Wow, okay. I mean, so it's just an old relationship. That,
very old.
Okay. Well, yep. That's...
They both do things the right way.
Yeah.
I mean...
And then your family got into butchering? I mean, it's not like you just carry it. You actually
No, my
butcher
grandfather
it.
Was a meat cutter.
Okay.
And then my dad, and I have did it. I work in the store now more than meat, but
okay.
We've all been around it forever.
Yeah. And then I haven't been in the back of your facility back there, but that's
You need to come back and check it out.
Okay.
It's extremely
well, what's going
clean.
On back
it's
there?
It's extremely clean and
So you're doing butchering, and you have like a... Yep. Cold storage and
Jeff's smoke room is spotless.
Wow.
He okay. makes sure of that.
Okay.
We both have our state license. We are under inspection weekly.
Wow, good.
And we have to make sure it's clean, and then we have a fellow from the state that comes in and checks us as well.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, just this is a little bit off topic, but I know that when I was at your store, you were telling me you also have Rocky Chicken, which is something we're always promoting.
Rocky and Rosie's.
Okay, but they're not really, you can't see them when you have to ask for them.
Yes.
Okay.
Jeff, tell them how that works.
Well, we don't have the storage space in the store. It's such a small store, so a lot of our products we keep in the back freezer, and we get them in frozen and keep them frozen to eliminate any shrink in an effort to try and keep the cost down.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. All right. Well, then, I appreciate you both coming on. I'm so impressed. I loved the products that I tried. I still have a couple that I haven't tried. I haven't tried the jerky, and I haven't tried the cured sausage.
Right.
Cheddarwurst.
The cheddarwurst, yeah. So I'll be letting you know. And people who just want to come and maybe get a little tour of what you're doing, can they do
just
that?
Just see me or Jeff. I'm Todd and Jeff. We're
okay.
both there all the time.
All right,
or
I love
ask
it
for
out
Ken
there.
As well.
And you know what? I appreciate your commitment to local producers. You know, you can walk through your store and you can see, you know, if somebody's growing something, they can
local produce all summer long.
Yeah, I mean that's what a nice commitment to our area. So keep up the good work. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
thanks for having us.
And you're going to be on Carl and Linda's show. It sounds like here next week. So catch them. So listen to that. Listen to Free Fire Radio 7 to 9. And I think you're going to be on Tuesday or the following Tuesday. One of these Tuesdays. So we'll figure
it out.
I'll
be back.
You'll be back. That's right. All right. So we're going to go to a break. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy on KCNR 1460.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Oh, welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. Oh, the effort of the show, of course, is to teach you stuff. Maybe you learned a little something about Kent's Meats right there. Maybe those are some of your favorite snack foods, and every time you go look for them at the store, they're full of nitrates and nitrites and all sorts of things you know aren't really necessarily health supportive. And so the guys out at Kent's have done an extraordinary job creating some clean food. They didn't add anything weird to their products, and so I highly recommend them. Our next guest is Jennifer Lombardi, and she is a marriage family therapist, and she is a co-owner of Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program. Jennifer, are you with us today?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on. You know, we've been trying to have a show about eating disorders for a while, and I really appreciate you making contact with us, and we can't wait to share information with our listeners. You know, part of what I do for a living is we're always sort of rebuilding the immune system and rebuilding the digestive system, which has a lot to do with, bacterial overgrowth, kind of like not-so-great bacteria growing in the digestive tract, which gives people a lot of bizarre emotional dysregulation. And some of that has to do with, you know, what we think of as diagnosable emotional imbalances that, you know, you would maybe get medicated for. And we help regulate them through regulating the digestive tract. And for some people, and, you know, several people, I would say, food just ends up being a funny thing where they're needing a little bit of comfort. And it's not about nutrition anymore. It's filling needs that are beyond nutrition. And so how is it that you got into this field, Jennifer?
Well, I've been recovered from anorexia for almost 18 years, and back when I was struggling, the resources for treatment options and really the understanding that we had about eating disorders was fairly limited. And so once I had recovered, I made the conscious decision to go back to graduate school and really wanted to make a difference and work with this population. And so I feel very fortunate now to be in a position where I can help people seek treatment resources and help educate families. So I feel very fortunate in the sense to not only be recovered, but to actually be in a place, because I'm one of those people that sort of thinks that things happen for a reason, and so I truly believe there was a reason why it came into my life, and so I wanted to have a purpose.
Now, right now you're currently in private practice in Sacramento. Is that pretty much clear, or...?
In a sense, it's myself and two other business owners that own a treatment center in Sacramento, and we offer a couple of different levels of care. The highest level of care that we offer is what's referred to as day treatment, where patients are with us 5 days a week all day and receive very intensive medical services, therapeutic services, and nutrition services. And then we have step-down programs from that.
So if they're needing the most intense part of the therapy, like what is the classic, you know, who are these folks? What are they suffering from?
Well, that's the interesting part. I mean, definitely we can treat individuals who are struggling with anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder. But what's been sort of interesting in the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years that I've been doing this, I am assessing people both younger and younger and older. And the youngest client that I've ever assessed was 7. And the oldest was 67. So it's no longer sort of the stereotypical eating disorders only affect, you know, young teenage girls, you know, 14 years old from wealthy families. That's far from the truth. These illnesses are impacting every ethnicity, every socioeconomic background, both males and females.
Now, do they all have a whole big host of different causes, or is there usually, does it all kind of boil down to one cause?
Well, the best way to explain it, the way I try to help families understand this, is to sort of think of it like a puzzle. And there are five pieces to that puzzle. The two most prominent, which we now know through research in the last 5 years, that really sort of put people at risk for developing an eating disorder, the number one piece of the puzzle is genetics. And most people would assume that if you have an eating disorder, what that would mean is you have family members who have had eating disorders. And actually, that's quite rare. Most of the time, people have a family history of primarily anxiety and then secondarily depression. And so that's one risk factor for somebody to develop an eating disorder. And then the second prominent piece of the puzzle that we know of are personality traits. But what's very common for individuals struggling with an eating disorder to have are personality traits such as perfectionism, being very driven, people-pleasing, and also very conflict or harm avoidant. These are folks who generally have an even tougher time with change or conflict, and so it's very distressing to them. So those are kind of the biological cornerstones of these illnesses. And then the other three factors that can certainly exacerbate or sort of set the stage and sort of instigate the eating disorder kicking in the first place can be such things as family dynamics, if there's a lot of conflict, or even pressure to achieve within a family system. That's one factor. And then the other ones are trauma or loss, and finally culture. And you and I could be here talking for hours about the negative influences of our culture. And so when we look at all five of those pieces of the puzzle, that really gives you a better understanding as to why someone would develop this illness and what are the things that are sort of supporting the maintenance of the illness.
Okay. Now, listeners can then sort of look right now and see, okay, I do have anxiety and depression. They can kind of look at these characteristics. Now, how is it or what is it that you do once you've identified this? How are you helping the person? Are you figuring out what is their primary trait and then working with that? Or if they have anxiety, are you going right to the anxiety and working with that? Or...
Well, I think the first thing is it's extremely important, you know, whether you're someone who's suffering or a family member, but also even for professionals who are trying to get people to recognize that, unfortunately, eating disorders have the distinction of having the highest death rate of any mental illness.
Interesting.
So 10% will die.
Wow.
And so it is a very, very life-threatening illness and disorder. Most people are not aware of that. They just assume, oh, it's a diet that's gone wrong, or this is a person that just wants control. And as I mentioned earlier, we know there are very strong biological motivators once the person starts engaging in these behaviors that are reinforcing for them to continue.
Now, why are they dying? Why are they dying? Are they dying of malnutrition?
Usually the number one cause of death is cardiac arrest.
Okay.
So these people are dying because either they are so malnourished that their heart slows down and then they go into cardiac arrest, but also even for people struggling with bulimia or binge eating disorder. You know, with bulimia, you can engage in the behaviors and throw the electrolytes off, which help your heart function, and that can cause cardiac arrest. So cardiac arrest is the number one reason, and then right behind that is suicide, because I think so often this is a very shameful illness, and people feel desperate, and they feel like they can't stop, and they lose a sense of hope. And so I do think if you know somebody or you yourself are struggling, it's absolutely imperative to get a thorough assessment by somebody who truly understands and treats eating disorders.
Oh, excellent. You know, we also think of it often as very female, and our co-host in the studio who is here with us now is Mark Beecham. Mark, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Trudy. This is a little difficult for me. I suffered from anorexia twice in my life, and I've never really talked about it publicly before. It's not that I feel, you know, shame or anything like that, but the first time I got it was I was traveling in India, and I guess it was the early 80s, and I lost a lot of weight because of, you know, the diet there and the heat and et cetera. And I noticed that my attitude toward food slowly began to change, and I began to think that there was somehow I was more virtuous by eating less. And as the weight fell off, it even became, you know, uncomfortable for me to sit down or lie down. But I still felt, you know, hell-bent on losing more and more weight. And in India, I remember being at one place, a movie being made, and Indian movie stars, by and large, are pretty zoftic people, big, fat people, as you might expect, in a poor country like that. And I just... mentally I started to hate these people because they were so big, I mean, and everyone else was so thin, and I was so thin. And it was something that just snowballed, and it lasted for maybe 6 months until, you know, finally sort of I came out of it. And it happened again in my life. And I'm curious, how prevalent is it among men, and is it a growing problem among men that you see?
Well, I can address that. I mean, definitely the estimates in the United States are that, you know, there's 8 million girls and women and about 1 million boys and men. And it's important that with those numbers to keep in mind, those are individuals who've actually been diagnosed with an eating disorder. That does not take into account the thousands and thousands that never get treatment, never are diagnosed. And the other interesting factor is that you will never see on a death certificate that the person died from an eating disorder. It's not been acceptable to put that on a death certificate. You might see cardiac arrest. But you won't see that. So the statistics that we have are understandably limited. But anecdotally, I completely agree. I'm assessing more and more adolescent boys in particular with eating disorders, and certainly more males in the last 5 to 6 years.
And what do you think is behind that, and how do they typically get it? I mean, I got mine through weight loss because of travel, and also I got too much involved in exercise, and I lost a lot of weight because of exercise. And I know that there's a personality trait in me that does kind of fit what you talked about earlier about perfectionism and control. Is that something that people need to be aware of and worry about?
Well, I do, and I'm going to try to simplify this as much as possible, because when I talk about the biological factors, you know, probably the easiest way to explain it, and to the viewers that are listening, is, you know, if you kind of cracked open and looked at everybody's brain, and in the very center portion of your brain, there's something called the amygdala. And the front portion of that, part of what that portion of your brain regulates are certain brain chemicals. Two in particular we know to be involved in the development and maintenance of an eating disorder are serotonin and dopamine. And so generally, people have heard of those brain chemicals, and they think, oh, those are kind of the feel-good chemicals of the brain. You know, if Ed McMahon showed up on your doorstep with a big check, that part of your brain would light up, and you'd be happy, and you'd feel good. And for most people, that's true. And so, you know, for an average person, the scale of those, you know, if we were to measure those, and again, very much simplifying this, on a scale of 1 to 10, Ed McMahon shows up, that part of your brain lights up on a 9 or a 10. And again, that's true for most people. What we know now for people who are at risk for developing an eating disorder is there's dysregulation in that system, that part of the brain. In other words, it's overactive. And so what that means is your scale is not 1 to 10. It's, you know, for argument's sake, 1 to 15. And with those brain chemicals, there's a crossover point where it's too much of a good thing, and it produces anxiety and distress. And so one of the ways that we produce those brain chemicals is through food consumption. So that is why for somebody who starts dieting or begins to restrict, when somebody who's struggling with anorexia says, well, I feel better when I don't eat as much. I feel like I'm in more control. I feel like I can think clearly. I kind of have this euphoric high. Biochemically, we now know there's truth to that, because they're self-medicating in a way. They're you know, by default, decreasing the overactivity of that portion of the brain. And so for them, it decreases their anxiety or distress, or that feeling to be driven, perfectionism, those kinds of things. And so that's sort of the biological hook that people fall into, which is why you can line up, you know, 10 to 15 teenage girls, they all start dieting, but only two or three of them develop an eating disorder, because for them, behavior means something different.
Aha, very interesting. Hey, we're going to take a quick commercial break here, Jennifer, and just stay on the line. And you're listening to Positively Healthy with Dr. Trudy Pratt on KCNR 1460. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. Something like that. Positively Healthy on KCNR.
Healthy.
What?
Healthy.
Healthy on KCNR 1460. And not in the studio, but on the phone, we have Jennifer Lombardi out of Sacramento, and she is the co-owner of the Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program. Hey, Jennifer, this is radio, and one of the things I know about radio is that people are listening, and they want to take down your information so they can contact you, and they might be getting into their car or getting out of their car or trying to go in a store. So let's kind of, you know, tell folks how they can get a hold of you.
Probably the easiest way would be to visit our website. And if you type in Summit, S-U-M-M-I-T, and then just Sacramento, you'll be able to access it very easily, or even Summit Eating Disorder Sacramento. And then on that website is a list of all of our staff, including myself, and my email address is on there. Our phone number is on there. And there's also a video that we have put together that people can watch to learn not just about our program, but also just about the process of recovery and eating disorders in general.
And what is the phone number?
The phone number to our program is 916-920-5276, and my direct extension is 11 if they want to get information about admissions.
5276? We kind of had a little cutout thing on your phone.
Sorry about that. 5276.
Okay. Okay. And then we've talked about the problem quite a bit here. I want to go into treatment a little bit. Like, what are the treatment options for people? And then we can come back and talk about the problem some more. But I want to kind of bounce over a little bit into treatment. And what do you do for these folks? And is it working?
Well, I think, you know, certainly, as I mentioned earlier, since, you know, the time that I was struggling, treatment has changed a lot. And it's currently, we're in a state of change again because of new research that's been coming out about different treatment methodology. But primarily, it's easiest to think of it in kind of three areas. The person needs to receive medical treatment, nutritional treatment, and then psychological treatment, and to also involve the family and support system as much as possible in that. But there are different levels of care. I mean, certainly there is inpatient hospitalization for people who are so medically compromised that they need sort of that intensive 24-hour supervision to get them out of you know, immediate danger, so to speak.
Now, are there that many people who are at that level when they get to you, or are they mostly not at that level?
You know, I will say, you know, one question I often get is how the economy is affecting these illnesses. And again, this is anecdotally, just through our program. What I notice is that people are waiting longer to actually seek treatment resources. And I think part of that is because of the fear of, you know, the economic impact or whether or not they might have to take a medical leave from work. But the other component, too, is this is such a shameful illness. And oftentimes people who struggle, I know certainly this is true for me, feel a tremendous sense of guilt as though they should just be able to get it together and really just, you know, be able to stop. And it's never that easy. You need a lot of support and a lot of supervision to help you. And so I think there's a lot of shame that with everything that's going on in the economy and in the world, this seems selfish to be struggling with this. And so the last thing I want to do is burden my family or the people around me.
Jennifer, you mentioned that you are a recovering or recovered anorexic. Is anorexia something like they say about alcoholism, that it's a lifelong issue that you have to struggle to keep at bay? Or is it something you can fully recover from and never look back on?
I'm one of those folks that believes in full recovery. I do think, you know, you might probably get a different answers depending on people you speak to who are recovered. I'm certainly not the only person that works in this field that's recovered. But, you know, the best way I can explain it is, you know, when I was struggling, my eating disorder was consuming. It was the first thing I thought of in the morning. It was the last thing I thought of at night. And every decision I made throughout the day was based on how to keep my illness secret or how to make sure that I could maintain it. And so, you know, it was kind of like immediate, sitting on my shoulder like a radio playing at level 10. And with recovery over time, not only does the volume go down on that eating disorder radio, it actually moves farther across the room. And so, you know, I would say there's something, you know, if you look at the research, there's something kind of magical around the five-year mark that for most people, you know, 75% or more, if they are able to recover and hold on to it for a period of 5 years, around that time, the you know, the rate of relapse drops dramatically.
Oh, and, that's wonderful.
And for me, I know that that's been true. And so, you know, do I have an eating disorder thought every once in a while? Sure. It's usually when I get stressed or I'm tired or overwhelmed and it'll kind of sneak up on me, but the difference now is that it's very clear to me how much energy and time I would have to dedicate to go back to that life, and what I'm very clear on what I would lose if I did. You know, I have a family now, and I have friends and work and all of those things that are very important to me. So there's something that shifts, and I think for people who work very hard at recovery, it doesn't feel like a burden. It's not something that I have to think of consciously all the time, and so I really, the drive to hold on to it is not there anymore.
That's very positive. Mark, do you have a question?
Yeah. How medically compromised or at risk were you at the worst of your illness?
Well, I can, knowing what I know now, with it as being a professional, it's both sad and frightening to me. I definitely think that the place I was in at that time, I may have needed inpatient hospitalization for a period of time. I mean, I was very, very sick, and unfortunately, like I said, there were not a lot of treatment resources, and I know I'm certainly not the only person that's experienced that, and so, you know, thankfully, we've come a long way as a treatment community and really understand these illnesses much better than we ever have before.
Oh, I love it. Hey, Jennifer, we're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. And you're listening to Jennifer Lombardi. She's the marriage and family therapist from Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program out of Sacramento. And she's our guest today, and we're learning so much. So you're listening to Positively Healthy on KCNR 1460. We'll be right back. Right, you're listening to Positively Healthy, and on the line we have Jennifer Lombardi, marriage and family therapist of Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Hey, you know what? I want to talk a little bit about the media, because I just, you know, how skinny are we all supposed to be? And I mean, it is a big deal, even though we've all heard so much about it, but maybe there are listeners out there that need to kind of reprogram their brains as far as what healthy is. Can you talk about what you think is the most offensive part of what we're brainwashed to believe?
Oh, my goodness, where to begin?
I know. I thought I'd throw it at you.
I mean, I have two small children now, and so I see it from a very different perspective. You know, there's an interesting study that was done a few years ago by one of the national organizations where they actually pulled about 3,000 8- and 9-year-olds, boys and girls, and ask them a whole host of questions, one of which is, you know, have you ever been on a diet? And they actually let the children define what diet was, and about 40% of them had. And by our terms as adults, they basically stopped eating as much in order to lose weight. And to me, I understand that we have a very, you know, serious obesity problem in our culture, but my concern with all of that is that even though the intentions are oftentimes very good, the methodology that we go about teaching our children about leading a healthy lifestyle is very misguided. I think it starts, one thing that's very clear to me is vilifying, you know, certain foods as good or bad. I mean, I think children absolutely need to eat good, nutritious foods, but there's also food for fun as well. And so if we talk about leading a balanced life, it has to incorporate that as well. And so there's that piece. And then I certainly think, you know, in our culture, you can look at any magazine cover, you can drive down the street and look at a billboard, and we're just inundated with negative messages about weight and appearance. And so it's profoundly sad to me that kids at very young ages are not at peace with their bodies. They have a very oftentimes unhealthy relationship with food. We're kind of setting ourselves up for major health problems down the road.
And for both boys and girls, or mostly girls, or just kind of, is it kind of even by now when they're young?
I think you see it with both boys and girls. I definitely think, as I said earlier, I'm assessing more teenage boys than I ever have, and oftentimes, you know, they have really no sense of, you know, what balanced eating is, and they sometimes, especially with boys in particular, have a very misguided view of what exercise is supposed to mean in their life.
What do they think it's for?
Well, a lot of times they're very competitive and they're very driven to excel, and there seems to be more and more pressure, especially with competitive sports. And it's not that I'm not a proponent of that. I don't want to speak ill of the competitive sporting industry, but I do think that for, again, some of these kids who are very sensitive and have certain personality traits and are highly anxious, they are the kinds of kids that are going to latch on in that environment and take it to the extreme, because it just is their nature to do so. And so it's hard as a parent, I think, because if you see your child pushing themselves in a particular sport or activity, we think, well, that's great. They must love it and wonderful that maybe they'll get a scholarship and all of these things. And I think there can be some downsides to that. It's very hard to pull back, you know, or pull a child back and say we need to slow down and look for balance, because I think we all have enough common sense to know that anything in the extreme is not a good idea.
Well, it seems like kind of as a nation, we've gone overboard with kids and their activities and deciding that they're the biggest, most important thing ever. I mean, just bringing that into balance seems like, wow. I mean, if a parent could do that to help their kid, that would be pretty dramatic on a lot of levels.
Right, and I think, you know, I oftentimes get asked, you know, what's the number one thing I can do for prevention? And what's kind of interesting is that it's something that we know to be helpful in preventing substance abuse, teenage pregnancy, and that is cooking with your kids and having family meals more often. That's the number one preventative medicine that I can give and suggestion I can give to people. But again, that's very hard because we live in a very active and busy life. You know, we're oftentimes running from one activity to the next, or, you know, you have both parents that are working at home, and so it is very stressful and it's very hard to carve out that time. But research has shown that it's one of the best ways to prevent, again, not just eating disorders, but other, you know, issues that parents become concerned with, especially as, you know, your child becomes a teenager.
Now, how is that preventative? Getting home, sitting down, having dinner, mom and dad mm-hmm. made the meal.
Mm-hmm. With the kids.
The whole family makes the meal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
The way that it can be helpful is, number one, it can help diversify children's food choices. I know I have a daughter, and, you know, trying to get her to eat kidney beans was just not going to happen. And what was interesting is the moment we made homemade chili together, she thinks kidney beans are the best thing under the sun now.
Ah, I like
part
that.
Of that is, you know, part of it is because she was cooking, and it was done with her. And so I think there's a piece of ownership and sort of an educational component that gets worked in without trying to, without having to try too hard. And so kids oftentimes do very well at learning by doing. And so I think that's another example of it. But then there's just sort of this unstated, you know, when you sit down at the dinner table saying you're special. I mean, kids are, in my mind, kids are pretty simple. They don't want to get in trouble, and they want to feel special. And so, you know, sitting down and taking that time to have a meal with them and talking about their day or laughing or talking about what didn't go so well, it's a way to show them that you care. And, you know, for children, that's key. You know, they need time and they need, you know, your undivided attention, and what better place to get it than when you're sitting at the dinner table together.
I love it. I see the connection. I think that's just the most valuable thing. Mark?
Jennifer, what percentage of American families today do you think actually do that on a regular basis, sit down as a family like that?
Yeah. Well, the last time I looked at the research, to be honest with you, was probably about almost a year ago. I had to do a presentation for a statewide school psychologist conference, and the research that I looked at the time said maybe a third actually do that, and that's down, you know, in the last 15, 20 years. And again, I think it's reflective of the things that I mentioned earlier. We're very busy and we're very stressed, and a lot of people commute to and from work, so there's a lot of time that gets cut out of our day. And, you know, when you get home, you're tired, and having to make a full meal, and it feels oftentimes so much easier just to grab something or let kids kind of go and do their homework while they're eating and, you know, be away from you. It does take a lot of energy, and it is a huge time commitment to do that. But, you know, people that are listening can do it, you know, one or two times more than you're doing it now, that's taking a huge step.
Oh, that's true. Good point.
And I think it's very effective for children.
You know, we're going to take a quick break, and here we are at National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and our guest is Jennifer Lombardi from Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program. And Jennifer, when we come back from the break, I do want to hear how you've carved out, like, what are you doing for your own kids to prevent this? And, you know, like, what did you give up, and what would a meal planning session at your house look like? And so this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. We'll be right back.
Today, most...
Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Welcome back. Hi, you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. I'm Trudy Pratt, and we're talking to Jennifer Lombardi, marriage and family therapist of Summit Eating Disorders and Outreach Program. And Jennifer, can you give your contact information again?
Sure. People can find us by going on the internet and typing in Summit, S-U-M-M-I-T, and then Sacramento, and possibly eating disorders, and they can find our website, or they can certainly give us a call at 916-920-5276.
I have a couple questions here before we part, and one is, do you offer anything for people who live this far away? Do you do some type of phone consult support for people?
We do. We can sometimes do assessments over the phone if the person can't actually come in. And if we do recommend treatment at our facility, we a few years ago we started offering housing for people that come from outside the greater Sacramento area. And so we have had patients who have come from northern, far northern California up to the Oregon border. And then as far south as, you know, Fresno and Bakersfield.
Okay. Well, good. So then you can serve, you have the capacity to serve a wide range of geography here.
Yes, we
okay.
do.
Now, before we close, in your own family, I'm just curious what decisions or choices you've had to make in order to keep the family together, to get the kids maybe going to the market and making dinner, and have you had to cut out a lot of things that you think you might regret someday, like they didn't learn to skate, or, I mean, all, you know, there's so much pressure for parents, they think they have to give their kid every opportunity when they start skipping things that are the most important of all, and how has that been for you as a parent?
I think the one thing that we certainly do is kind of let our kids pick one activity at a time and not to overload them, and to also remember, you know, with certain activities in sports, there's during, you know, certain times of the year, there's a lot more going on. For example, my daughter has done theater, and so there have been times where for a couple of weeks, very intensive, it's many nights a week. And so one thing that we try to do is to take it in stride. I mean, to understand, and no one's perfect. Our family's certainly not perfect. You know, but we definitely try to have at least 2 to 3 meals together every single week at dinner time, where we sit down and we make the meal and we sit at the dinner table and kind of hang out together. But, you know, when you have those weeks where you're busier, you may have to back off, but then to always remember to get back on track with it as soon as that crunch time has passed.
And with all of their homework, are they able to help out in the kitchen, or?
Yeah, you know, with my kids, it's fortunate where they can, you know, when they get done with school, they'll sit down and do their homework, and then by the time dinner rolls around, we're ready to rock and roll with making dinner and, you know, again, sitting and preparing it together.
And what kind of foods do they like to prepare? Like, what is kind of a fun thing for them?
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I found kind of by accident is when we do go out to a restaurant, if my kids are something that they like, we'll try to see if we can replicate it at home. And it's nothing extravagant. I mean, kids usually like pretty simple foods, but I know one in particular, my kids really like tomato soup, which I was like, well, that's great. If you love tomato soup, fantastic. We can certainly try to replicate that at home. And so those are the kinds of things I like to see, you know, are there certain things that you've liked at restaurants that we can try to replicate at home? And then also letting them go on the internet and do some searches because there's some wonderful children's cookbooks that are available now.
Oh, wonderful. Hey, we need to wrap it up real fast. We're just kind of running out of time. I didn't monitor our time that closely, but I want to thank you for coming on. I really appreciate all your information, and I think it's going to help a lot of people today. So,
well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, good. You're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460.